The years of World War II have been brought to life very vividly over the decades, but for those who were there, childhood memories of that time are particularly precious. Now the writer Rodney Hall has written a memoir of what life was like in wartime England from the perspective of his five-year-old self. It's an unusual technique, but one that really illustrates how ordinary lives were affected. Rodney Hall joins me now from our Melbourne studio. Welcome to Life Matters.
Good morning, Richard.
Let's start with that decision to tell the story in your child's voice. Why did you do it that way?
Well, it isn't a story, for a start, Richard. What it is a collection of memories. I do have very vivid memories of the war years, and I can isolate them to the war years because straight after the war, we moved. And so all the memories that take place in that one place, I know belong in those years. I can't, at this stage, of course, be certain in what order they happened. So I had to allocate them to the 4 years or so, 4.5 years that the book covers.
Mm.
So, yes, it was a decision really I came to because I was testing out the manuscript of an orthodox autobiography with a young colleague who said, look, you know, if you want young readers, we're not so interested in all this sort of contextualization and factual stuff. We're actually interested in the experience. We're interested in the child's experience. And, you know, I'm a novelist and a professional writer, and I've been that since 1961. And it then turned into a new challenge because I think I've never read a book that attempted to do this, to just relive the moments without any connecting material.
Well, obviously, it's difficult to remember conversations of 60-odd years ago. How did you go about filling in the blanks?
Ah, yes. Well, of course, you have to do that. But part of your memory isn't just what happens. It's how people talked and what was sort of characteristic of their talk. So reconstructing the things people might have said is not that difficult. Keeping an authenticity to the real feel of how life was. And that's what I'm attempting to do, is to get inside what it felt like to be a little boy living in a very small country town not far from Bristol and having random occasional bombs fall in bombing raids, because I mean they weren't, obviously it wasn't like the Blitz, it wasn't a systematic bombing of our area of the southwest of England. It was bombers, roughly speaking, offloading remaining bombs to gain height and speed on their way back home. That's when the bombs dropped.
Can you remember being afraid or sensing that the adults around you were fearful?
Oh, yes, it was. Of course, it was terrifying. And the book opens with a scene with us, with the air raid sirens going off, and my brother and sister and I pushing the settee back against the piano keyboard, a big upright piano we had, and crawling into the tunnel, and our mother crawling in after us. And there's not much room under a keyboard, as you'll know if you've ever tried it, on the basis that if a bomb hit the building, that these sorts of tunnels help preserve life, because when the roof fell in, you would have some protection from being crushed. Of course, the thing that never occurred to me, I have to say, until I was in my 40s, actually, was that our little flat was built over a service station. And, of course, under the service station were great tanks of fuel. So the roof falling in would have been the least of our worries,
yes,
if a bomb had actually hit us.
Though I dare say your mother was aware of it.
I'm sure she was absolutely aware of it. And she kept us calm in a very, very courageous way. And she would bring out her photographs. It was always at night, of course, raids. She'd bring out her photographs of home, as she called it, which was Kangaroo Valley. My grandparents had a farm near Kangaroo Valley at Yarunga. And she would have a pencil torch and pass these photographs. We never saw them at any other time. It was our treat during bombing raids to be shown photographs of Australia and told that when the war finished, we would go back home where there was no war.
It's a powerful thing, and it stayed with you. And, of course, those photographs, Kangaroo Valley, for people who haven't been there, is a very beautiful part of New South Wales, and I'm sure it takes a spectacular photograph. So those stories, they sort of sustained you, and they've stayed with you.
Oh, they did, Richard. There's no doubt they did. And we were, see, my father had died when I was 6 months old, well before the war. He died in 1936. And my mother had been a widow since, and she had a beginning career as an opera singer, and that had collapsed when she became pregnant. I mean, women will understand that that's how things were in those days. So she'd lost her profession. She had no training in anything else. She took a base grade clerk's job in the Ministry of Food and lived with constant migraine headaches. And we three children, my elder brother and sister and I, we were sort of street children. We did all the shopping for the house and the cooking, and except on weekends. And even on those weekends when my mother worked a half day on Saturday, we still did the housework. The one thing she always did was the clothes washing, but we did an awful lot of the housework. And we did the shopping and took charge of the money, and we were known by all the shopkeepers in town, often for bad reasons. We were, I think we were pretty naughty at times. But we did live on the street, and
you,
we became,
you actually had a lot of freedom, didn't you?
We
you
had
roamed
a huge
a lot.
Amount of. We had a huge amount of freedom, Richard. And you know, the book, I hope, is a tribute to my brother and sister, who are both still alive and who were wonderful. You know, I mean, we were a little gang of our own. Mm. And I mean, it must have been very hard on my brother, who was 5 years older than me, to always have his young brother and sister tagging along everywhere he went and never be able to really go out and mix with boys his own age. That must have been very hard on him. But he was the sort of surrogate father, and he kind of protected us and looked after us and ordered us around and was generally bossy in the nicest way.
You were in his gang, in effect.
Yes.
On Life Matters, my guest is the award-winning novelist Rodney Hall, and we're talking about, well, not fiction, but his memoir, a childhood memoir of World War II, growing up outside of Bristol in the UK before coming to Australia. Now, times were tough, but that is not what children really remember, is it?
No. And in fact, most of the book, I think some of it, I hope, is funny. Most of it, I think, is quite airy and light. And it's to do with the things that concern all children growing up, how they relate to understanding the adult world. And I mean, the title, Popeye Never Told You.
I was going to ask you that.
Yes. Well, it really comes from the fact that, you know, we didn't have books in our house. My mother wasn't a great reader. When she read sort of crime novels. But we had comics, and one of the comics, my favourite comic was Popeye, because Popeye was, you know, he was always bashing people up, and he had a tattoo, and he wouldn't take nonsense from anyone and so forth. So I kind of, in a way, he was just my favourite. And so there's a number of references in the book to Popeye, and hence the title Popeye Never Told You.
I'm struck by some of the other little kind of vignettes, and in many ways the book's a collection of vignettes. So when you've kind of see whale meat for sale, or you know, the idea of, and look, we did this in my childhood, sharing a bath to save water.
Yeah.
And the food parcel from Australia, when that arrived.
Yes, well, that was a great event, the first food parcel. We had a number of them, but the first one was so astonishing. I mean, to us, I mean, you have to bear in mind that with the kind, I know there were food shortages here, but the kind of food shortages we had in Britain during the war at that time were very severe. And another of those little vignettes is finding the first orange I'd ever tasted in, I was about six, in a Christmas stocking. It was a Christmas treat, and it seemed sort of more impossibly orange as a colour than I could ever have believed an orange could be, and let alone the taste of it. And then the food parcel, which had foods that I'd never tasted, like pineapple, which when we opened the tin, I thought it was going to be a kind of apple.
Well, why not? Of course.
And the things that you remember, you know, sort of little things that are...
And
no,
you got the butter, and you thought you'd lost because of
I'd
that.
Lost because we didn't have much butter because of rationing, but yeah, I got... we had a lucky dip. My mother made it into a game when the parcel was open. We had to close our eyes and and get a lucky dip, and I got the tin butter, which I was furious about. But it turned up. I mean, she managed to turn it into a celebration. She had a great gift for that. I mean, in many ways, she was a difficult woman, my mother, something of an acquired taste. But she had courage. She had immense amounts of courage. And she was angry. She was angry with life, really, because she had a quite glittering beginning to her career and had married a man who was the chief engineer for Rover Cars and was their European representative. And she travelled and she lived the high life and then suddenly got left with nothing and three children to bring up in a desperately dangerous time.
What I am struck by is the vividness of the memories of, I suppose, these relatively small things which stay with people and are very evocative. So like the pong of the paraffin oil heater or playing Skittles out the back and sacking on an OXO soup cube.
Yes. Yes, they're all there. I work on one principle, Richard. I think in a long lifetime, if you remember something, however trivial it may seem, if you remember it, it wasn't trivial. It has to be honoured, because why would we, like remembering, as you say, sucking on an OXO cube or failing to learn to tie shoelaces. There must have been something at the time that made this a totally memorable thing, and I don't question that. In fact, these are all the memories I had. And after I'd written the book, I had a meeting with my a gathering with my brother and sister and my aunt, who was 10 years older than my elder brother.
Mm.
And the four of us sat round. They all read the manuscript and sat round talking about it. And it was very fascinating to find how we had different memories, different slant on the same memories. In some cases, there were things that none of them remembered that I did. There were cases, of course, of things they remembered that I didn't. But I had to retain the integrity of the fact that these were my genuine life. So I didn't change anything except one word. I had not remembered the name of the chemist. The chemist was quite important to us because we had kind of chemistry set as a hobby, and we made explosives, I have to say, in a mild sort of and botched way, but still things that went off bang. And we used to go and buy saltpeter and things from the chemist. And my aunt said, "Oh, Mr. North." And so I put Mr. and Mrs. North's name in there, which was actually literally the only thing from those conversations that changed the manuscript.
Well, you finally made it to Australia when you were 13.
Yes.
What was it like to go to Kangaroo Valley, that place that had held all that promise for you?
Well, we didn't go to Kangaroo Valley first. We went to Brisbane because my mother's sole remaining relative in Australia was a cousin who lived in Brisbane. And her married name was Morehouse, and she had nominated us out so my mother could come out on the assisted migrant scheme, at least with the two younger ones of us. So Australia, it was not just Kangaroo Valley, it was the whole of Australia that was this promised land. It was devastating, actually, at first, because my mother had by mail secured a job in western New South Wales at Coonabarabran, or a little place called Ulamambri. And so no sooner had we landed in Brisbane, but like literally a week later, staying with this cousin of hers, who had booked my sister and I into boarding schools, then my mother set off on the train to Coonabarabran, and we were put in boarding schools. And my very first thing, I was a couple of days before the term began, I'd settled myself in the dormitory, and some of the early arriving boys came in, and I spoke to them, and one of them said, "Oh, he's a pommy here," and another one, they all gathered round, and then somebody punched me in the face. That was my very, that was my kind of introduction.
Yes.
I came to love it afterwards.
Yes. But you weren't there for long, were you? I mean, you were at 16,
no.
You left.
Oh, yes, I left school at 16, but I wasn't a boarder all that time. My mother couldn't afford it. It turned out to be another foolish enterprise. She, in her lifetime, engaged in a number of sort of financially foolish enterprises. She really didn't have much gift for money. So we were only at those schools for a year before we had to be taken out and just do ordinary day school. It was traumatic, as it was.
Yes. When you look back as an adult on this stage of your life, especially the very early years, which most of the memoir is about, how defining is that experience?
I think it's a very good question, Richard, because these are isolatable to a certain age. And I have to say, for example, my whole family had a terrible tragedy only a few years ago with our house burning down, with absolutely everything in it gone. And it did occur to me that my own way of dealing with it and thinking about it was informed by the fact that my earliest memories are of somebody's house being blown up across the street. And so maybe deeply ingrained in me was a lesson that no one had ever said to me, but life had demonstrated that things don't last. You can't hold on to them, and you have to get on with what you can get on with. So, yes, I think it, in all sorts of ways, and in negative ways as well. People ask, the recent Sydney Writers' Festival, I was on a panel about the lost father, because I grew up without a father. Mm-hmm. And it was an assumption that was a loss in my childhood and that it was something that I missed and grieved over. Well, yes, the book makes clear that it was a big absence in my life, but it wasn't necessarily a negative absence. I mean, when other boys' fathers came home from the war on leave, my observation was that they generally beat their sons or got drunk and behaved badly. And I actually had the view that I got away with it, that there was, you know, it was kind of, I got lucky that I didn't have a father. So it wasn't just, and of course those things again also cast a long shadow through your life. The fact of not having had a father and not having kind of in a way had any realistic idea of what having a father would mean.
I'm struck though, Rodney, how you telling a series of simple stories adds up to a very complicated one. It's been a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you so much, Richard. It's a great pleasure to talk to you.
That is the award-winning writer Rodney Hall, and Popeye Never Told You, Childhood Memories of the War, is published by P&I Books. Do you have memories of a childhood in World War II? Do you remember Pongy heaters and playing Skittles like Rodney Hall or their Australian equivalents? Get in touch. abc.net.au/rn/lifematters is the website. The story-based commenting is going. And you can give us a ring on 02-833-1430. Now, from the past to the future, the jobs of the future.